Good morning, Denny.
Good morning.
I'm Sarah Posner with Religion Dispatches, and my guest today is Denny Burke. He is an associate professor of biblical studies at Boyce College, which is the undergraduate arm of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and he also has a blog at dennyburke.com. And we're going to talk today about evangelical reaction to the election results and how evangelicals are feeling about the future of their relationship with the Republican Party in electoral politics. And I understand that you're a theologian, and not a politics guy, but you follow this sort of stuff, and I think you probably have some thoughts on it.
Correct.
And so one of the things I wanted to ask you about right out of the box was right after the election, you did a blog post about not retreating from your position in opposition to same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was an election where, as we all know, there are four states that either passed same-sex marriage laws as a ballot referendum or beat back an effort to amend the state constitution to ban same-sex marriage. And so it seems like the public opinion is shifting in a direction that's in opposition to your position. But you seem to take the position that the politics of it or the public opinion question of it doesn't matter, and that you're going to stick with your position. Does that also mean that you think that evangelicals should continue to, or Catholics or anybody else who's who has a similar religious belief to you, should continue to fight this on the political, in the political arena?
Well, you know, as a Christian, I look at this from two different perspectives. Number one, the first perspective I look at it as is just as a pastor, as a believer who cares about these issues, we have a responsibility and a duty to stand for marriage. And so my proclamation, my witness that I want to put forth as a Christian is always going to be in favor of traditional marriage. God made them male and female in the beginning, and for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cling to his wife. So marriage is strictly defined in the Bible, and so that's why I'm saying that we would never, as Christians, back away from our definition of marriage. And so the whole culture can go one way, but we'll have to be a counterculture in the midst of that if we're going to be faithful to scriptural revelation. So that's one perspective that I'm coming from, and that's why I say I'm never going to back down from this. Now, when it comes to how do we engage as Christians in the civil body politic, that's a different issue, because at this point we're looking at what's going to be possible going forward. I think the coalition of people willing to go forward in favor of traditional marriage is actually shrinking, and I think that it's traditional religious conservatives are going to have difficulties with this. I mean, when you look at it, I mean, look where we are right now on the issue of gay marriage. People are still talking about this on my side of things as if this is something that might come upon us in the future. This is upon us now. When you look at this current Supreme Court term, they're going to rule at some point within the next year on the issue, on Proposition 8 coming out of California. A lower court had overturned that, and my view is it's in all likelihood the Supreme Court's going to uphold that. If that happens, that means that California is going to clear the way for legalizing same-sex marriage. When that happens, that means that we'll have all of our coastal cities, major coastal cities, and several other states in which it is legal for same-sex couples to marry. That means that over half of the American population will live in places where it is legal to be married as a same-sex couple. Over half of the population of America will live in a place where it's legal for same-sex marriage. So this is already upon us. This is not something that's in the future. This is already a reality. And my view is that public opinion has moved away from us on this. And so we're going to have to be asking the question, what kind of a political coalition is possible in order to advance same-sex marriage? I mean, excuse me, traditional marriage, if that's even possible anymore.
Well, I think if you look at public opinion polling data, it seems like this is not a battle that your side is going to win. You do have, the three states, which may not demographically be representative of other states in the country, Maryland, Maine, and Washington State, but passing it at the ballot box. This is the first time that that happened, as opposed to a legislative or judicial move to legalize same-sex marriage. So this was the voters saying, a majority of the voters saying, yes, we want same-sex marriage to be legal in our state. And when you look at national polling data, I think if you break it down by religion, you see that evangelicals are one of the few religious demographic groups that are still a majority opposed to same-sex marriage. But the majority of Americans, a slim majority of Americans as a whole, are for it. So, do you think that you're going to continue, or evangelicals are going to continue to commit political resources as opposed to, I don't know how to distinguish political resources from other resources, but you know what I'm saying, political resources in terms of fighting political battles about this in the face of that change in public opinion?
Yeah, well, for evangelicals, I think our main political resource is just our witness. In other words, that we keep speaking in favor of traditional marriage. We support candidates who would favor traditional marriage. But what I'm saying is that even though we're going to continue to do this, I agree with you. I think that by and large in the culture, it's going away from us. The polling is clear on this. The ground is moving beneath our feet. I do not think the culture at large agrees with us on the sanctity of traditional marriage. There is still a large vocal minority. Okay. It's pretty close right now, the polling, but it's very clear that it's going against us on this. And so the issue for evangelicals going forward is not whether or not we're going to continue to support traditional marriage. It's just whether or not there's going to be a political coalition that would represent us anymore. And that's where I think that, I think it's up in the air right now where the Republican Party is going to be on this in 4 years. It's just, it's up in the air. And so that's what I mean by, I don't know that there'll be a political coalition or a party that would represent our interests completely on marriage anymore.
But do you think would that be a deal breaker? I mean, where would evangelicals go if the Republican Party said, look, we're not going to fight this marriage battle anymore. We're just going to let it take its course at the state level and not even really raise it in presidential campaigns, at least. What do you think evangelicals would do if that's what comes about in the presidential election in 2016 or 2020 or even 2024?
I think what you'll find with most evangelicals is that the transcendent social issue that they care about is abortion, even more so than gay marriage. Now, marriage is important to us, but traditional marriage, supporting that is important to us. But abortion is the transcendent issue. So I think you'll still see a coalition around that issue, and I think there's actually more promising prospects, actually, in the culture at large for advancing that cause. So I don't see a complete fracturing in the next 4 to 8 years of social conservatives because of the marriage issue. You may see... I'm not sure how quickly all this is going to move. Okay, so I'm just being honest with you here in terms. In terms of political analysis, my gut feeling is that by 2016, the marriage issue is going to be off of the table. I think the Supreme Court probably will have ruled on it by then. I think it probably will have gone against us, and so I think what you'll probably see is traditional conservatives who support traditional marriage actually retreating to defend the religious liberty issues involved with the definition of marriage. I don't know if you saw that article by Rod Dreher from last week in the American Conservative. I think he had the most insightful commentary in terms of where our culture is on marriage that I've read. And then he says that we're probably, as conservatives, going to have to retreat to defend religious liberty when it comes to our differences over marriage, while there's still room in the culture to appeal to them for that. Because that's going to be the big issue for us.
Now, I'm maybe a little bit Maryland-centric because that's where I live, but the law that passed the legislature and then passed by a majority of the voters on Election Day included, in my view, a lot of religious liberty protections. And there were pastors who cut ads for the pro-marriage equality side in Maryland, vouching for the religious liberty protections in the Maryland law. You know, no clergy person obviously would be forced to perform a marriage ceremony, and other religious liberty protections in there. Is there something more that you would be looking for? Something, what more specificity would you want a law to have if to protect religious liberty? Because it seems like some of these laws that have passed have religious liberty protections in them, but so it's unclear to me what more religious liberty protections you're looking for.
Sure. I'm not familiar with the religious liberty exemptions in the Maryland law. I was actually talking to a resident from Maryland yesterday, and she was trying to explain them to me. So forgive me for not being familiar with those. But I guess my concerns overall are that when I've seen some of the exemptions, they actually end up being pretty narrow, so that they only apply to pastors or to churches, and they don't extend to Christians who are just participating in the public space. So, for instance, if a Christian business owner, you know, has an employee who happens to be a homosexual and who is married, is this Christian business owner now supposed to recognize that marriage in terms of benefits or whatever else? In other words, it's not, I'm trying to invent a scenario here, but there are any number of scenarios that would involve people who aren't employed by a church, who are just Christians, but who, as a matter of religious liberty, don't want to have to submit to a definition of marriage that they find abominable. So you can't define religious liberty as something that just happens within the doors of a church. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's similar to the HHS mandate that everybody has been debating this past year. The HHS mandate.
The contraception mandate.
Yeah, in other words, the exceptions there are so narrow, they only apply to churches and a few closely related institutions. And so you've got organizations like Hobby Lobby, who's owned by a Christian business owner, who feels that abortion is against his religion. Well, now he's got to purchase insurance services that would actually provide abortifacient drugs, Ella and Plan B. So, he's not a church. Hobby Lobby's not a church. It's just a Christian business owner trying to run business as a Christian. And so, a lot of people define religious liberty as something that starts and stops at the doorway of the church. And where you see social conservatives coming and saying, wait a minute, that is not how religious liberty has been defined over American history. It's something that goes to individuals and the way that they live their lives. It's so that the government doesn't intrude and say that you have to run your life or your business in a way that violates your conscience.
Well, I guess I actually think that what you're describing is that you're framing out what the future culture war, if you want to use that phrase, is going to look like. Because I've been writing a lot about the contraception mandate and the lawsuits that have been filed to try to stop the implementation of it, and which have been filed by Catholic institutions and, like you said, private companies that say that they're religious. And I've actually heard legal experts talk about, and some of the legal briefs in some of those cases representing the private companies, talk about using the Citizens United decision to try to say, well, you know, corporations have free speech rights, therefore they have religious conscience rights as well. And I really think that that's getting into some territory that we haven't really seen before. We really haven't seen private companies object to complying with legal requirements or regulatory requirements on those grounds. And to me, it opens up a whole arena of possible objections that, in a way, could be extend far beyond just marriage and contraception or insurance coverage. And so I wonder, well, where will that end? And I actually don't know. We obviously don't know what the legal outcome of these lawsuits is going to be. The contraception mandate will probably go all the way to the Supreme Court too. So, how far would you want to see that go? Would you want private companies to be able to say, or, you know, a company that was owned by a Muslim to be able to say, well, I don't want to do this or that because it violates or interferes with my religious beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not something that's limited to Christians.
Mm-hmm.
This would, in other words, the religious liberty concerns could apply to any number of different religious persons. So it's not something that I would want just applied to Christians. But, you know, I understand the slippery slope argument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But right now, the clear and present danger to religious conservatives is they're being asked to pay for insurance that covers abortions, basically abortifacients.
Well, I think that there's some dispute about whether that's the effect that those drugs have. And, you know, the Food and Drug Administration, I know this argument because I've had it before with religious conservatives. The Food and Drug Administration does not classify them as abortifacients. They classify them as emergency contraception. And the medical consensus is that they do not act to prevent implantation, which is the claim of Hobby Lobby and Tyndale House and some of the other groups, some of the other organizations or companies that are suing HHS.
Yeah, that's incorrect. And also the officials who define what contraception is typically don't agree with us in terms of what constitutes human life. If you the way we define things is that life begins at conception, before implantation, and there are a lot of medical authorities who don't agree with that. And so contraception to them does include things that prevent methods that prevent implantation. And when it comes to some of these methods, you have to remember that not all of them have just one mechanism that are in play when it comes to the way that these work inside of the body. Sometimes they're preventing contraception. Sometimes they're actually preventing implantation,
or they're
doing
conception.
Both. And so if one mechanism fails, the other one comes in. And so when it comes to Plan B and Ella, these are all considered abortifacients. And
by social conservatives, but not by drug regulators, and not by most doctors.
Yeah, depending on how you define where life begins. Like I said, a lot of them believe that life begins at implantation or that something special happens there, whereas we hold that as soon as sperm and egg unite, there's a conception.
Right,
and there's a person.
But that's how Ella and Plan B work. They prevent fertilization.
No, that's not correct. That's not the only way that they work.
But if a religious view of how a drug works conflicts with...
That's not a religious view. That's a medical view. You need to go look at the mechanisms for Plan B and for Ella. They don't just prevent conception. That's a medical view.
That's one medical view.
Correct. But in other words, you shouldn't define this as a religious view in terms of how these drugs work. This is a public knowledge sort of this is something that's out there. So it's not just really,
there's also a public knowledge that
how these things work.
Right.
No, this is how they work.
But there's a public knowledge that's out there too that says that they work by preventing fertilization. And so there's been a lot written about this.
Okay.
So, but it seems to me that, I mean, because I read the Tyndale House brief, and they just got a preliminary injunction. They sued. Tyndale House is a Bible publisher that sued to try to enjoin the enforcement of the contraception, the HHS mandate, as to them. And I read their brief, and they just were awarded a preliminary injunction, so they don't have to comply with it for the time being, unless the court rules permanently in their favor. And their brief doesn't really talk about medicine, but talks, you know, quotes the Bible. And so the question that raised to me when I read their brief is, well, you know, who gets to decide? You know, so are the courts going to decide some of these questions based on what the Bible says or based on what this particular interpretation of the Bible says? That seems to me to be getting into territory that the courts biblical interpretation. I don't know. As a Bible studies professor, do you want to see the courts start interpreting the Bible?
Sure. Well, my view is that the courts should probably just stay out. The government should stay out of it altogether. In other words, they shouldn't be requiring religious people to do something that violates their conscience. They don't have to define whether or not they agree with what their conscience teaches. That's completely out of their purview. So that's the whole problem with this, is that in other words, when this whole controversy over the HHS mandate first began, a lot of the public mistakenly believed that religious conservatives were trying to bar access to contraception or to even some of these other methods. That's not what this was about. The problem was is that the government is telling people who have objections to these methods, they're telling them that they had to spend money to pay for them for other people. So nobody's trying to bar access to it. We're just saying we shouldn't have to pay for it. Now, the government doesn't have to agree with what our definition of life is or where life begins, but they shouldn't be requiring us to pay for it for somebody else. That's the issue. So nobody's trying to bar contraception or to make it sound like it's illegal or whatever. But what we are saying is that we shouldn't be made to pay for it by the government.
But can you imagine other scenarios where similar religious objections could be made? And I guess the healthcare arena maybe presents more of these opportunities than other types of regulations. But, I mean, do you think that people or companies or nonprofit organizations should be allowed to raise whatever religious objection they want to any government regulation and just say, I need to be exempt from this because of my religious beliefs?
Well, where you're going to find difficulty is when it comes to religious conservatives having a coalition on these issues, and where you'll hear a loud voice coming from a large constituency of Americans, is really coalescing around three issues: religious liberty, abortion, and marriage. And so if somebody comes along and starts making frivolous claims or objections to having to participate in this or that service, if it's frivolous, you're not going to see a groundswell in favor of it. But if it's a legitimate religious liberty objection, and especially if it involves one of those issues that I just listed, that's where you're going to hear the groundswell from social conservatives and evangelicals.
Okay, let's pivot to another. I know you have to go to another meeting, and so I wanted to get in this other topic while we were talking, and that is the evangelical relationship with the Republican Party. And, you know, so we talked earlier about how you think that probably, you know, by the next election cycle, the next presidential election cycle, the marriage issue will be pretty much off the table. Do evangelicals feel, well, first of all, do you think that evangelicals were disheartened by the fact that there was a huge turnout for Mitt Romney, but Romney lost the election anyway? And secondly, what do you see the future of this relationship with the Republican Party, which has been so solid for the past few decades? Is there any kind of soul searching? You know, do evangelicals feel like maybe the Republicans are taking them for a ride and not actually taking their issues that seriously? What do you think that? What's your, you know, you have your finger on the pulse. What do you think the thinking is at this time?
Yeah, I think evangelicals were surprised by the last election. A lot of social conservatives, unfortunately, were not watching the polls. If you were watching the polls, I was predicting that Obama would win all along. Mm-hmm. And my predictions before the election were that I picked 48 states right.
You didn't think the polls were skewed.
What was that?
You didn't think the polls were skewed. You thought the polls were predicting what the outcome was going to be.
Oh, yeah, they were. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was mm-hmm. very clear. It wasn't just one poll. Mm-hmm. I mean, this would have had to have been a conspiracy of epic proportions if all the polls were wrong, because they were going in a clear direction for months.
Right.
All the battleground states, the best that Romney ever got was even in some of them, and then only temporarily. It was mainly mm-hmm. they were mainly favoring in towards Obama the whole time. So I thought it was clear what was coming all along. I wrote about it on my website mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All my friends were not happy with me. They thought I was, you know, being overly negative. But I thought it was, right. I thought it was clear what was coming. So, but it was astonishing to me how many social conservatives and really just conservatives in general were wrong about this and were thinking that a Romney landslide was coming. So that didn't seem to be in the cards. So the first thing I'd say is that evangelicals, I think, were largely, a lot of them, surprised by the results and weren't realizing that this was going to happen this way. I think that a lot were probably surprised by the way that gay marriage went in those four states where it was on the ballot. Mm-hmm. That, you know, all four states basically had votes on gay marriage, and it's the first time that a state has ever, in a popular election, voted basically in favor of gay marriage, and it happened in four states at once. Mm-hmm. That was huge. So this narrative that evangelicals have had up until this time that, well, we know what the polling says, but every time it goes to a vote in a state, it never passes. Well, that narrative is over. It's happened in four states now, and I think we're going to see that more states will fall in future years. So when it comes to the way that evangelicals relate to the Republican Party in general, yes, they'll be rethinking their relationship. I think that we're going to have a prophetic voice to the party. If the party begins to drift on the issue of marriage, we're going to have to be saying, we disagree with you on this. And we're going to have to see what kind of coalition we can cobble together, if it's still possible, to protect religious liberty when it comes to issues of defining marriage. I think that's what's going to happen. I still think that evangelicals will see that there's only one party that supports life. I don't think that the Republicans are going to kick life to the curb over the next 4 years. And so there'll still only be one party that supports the pro-life cause, and so you won't see evangelicals defecting much on the basis of that. If the Republican Party ever comes to the point where they're kicking the life issue to the curb and the marriage issue to the curb, I think all bets are off then. And then you're going to see evangelicals making prudential judgments and splintering to figure out which party, which candidate, which race is best going to approximate their views.
So now that I know that you're an avid reader of polls, I wanted to ask you quickly about the recent Pew survey, the one that showed the increase in the number of the unaffiliated or the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, and also the Public Religion Research Institute survey, which found pretty much the same thing. I mean, do those numbers worry you? I mean, particularly, I think, when you look at the 18 to 29-year-olds.
Sarah, I'm sorry. You kind of broke up on me there. The Pew survey that said what?
The rise of the unaffiliated, the N-O-N-E-S, not the nuns.
Oh, okay.
Right. And also the Public Religion Research Institute survey. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but it found similar. It had a similar finding with the increase in the number of unaffiliated voters. Unaffiliated by religion.
Oh, unaffiliated by religion.
Yeah.
I think it fits. I haven't read either of those polls.
Okay.
But it does fit the trend of an increasing secularizing America, so it's not surprising to me at all.
So does it worry you? Do you think that evangelicals are losing ground with younger folks, millennials, 18 to 29-year-olds?
I'm not worried, even if we are losing ground. Okay, I'm not worried that the cause of, for me, the cause of Christ is what's preeminent, and so I have a very specific religious motivation in everything that I'm doing, and so it's fine that to participate in the public sphere and to argue for policies that we think promote the common good, but I'm not ultimately, when those things go against us, going to be hopeless or sad or, think that the world's coming to an end. You know, so am I concerned that there is a dip in religious affiliation or people who are publicly identifying with evangelical? Yeah, I am. But mainly because I'm concerned with the progress of our faith.
Not because of its effect on politics.
Yeah, that's a secondary consideration for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, thanks so much for doing this today. It was very interesting to talk with you.
Absolutely.